Blog Talk Radio.
Hoor jy die magtige trene? Oor die veld kom dit wyd gesweef. Die lied van 'n volk se ontwaking, wat harte laat sidder.
Ek smoeg vir die vrese waarmee ons moet lewe, vir gans en vir moord en vir ryp. Ek smoeg vir die bad news, vir Zuma en sy views, waarna ons op TV moet kyk. Ek wil nie meer hoor hoe ons tieners begrawe, oor niemand hul steur aan die wet. Ek wil nie meer lees van affirmative action, of beklei om te hou wat ek het. Gee vir my een nieuwe gein, een koos toe plezier en een tellerij, wat liefkie sing en skry en sy, oor die mooi van ons land, en ons recht om hier te kan blij. Ek siek vir my lemma, sy leens en sy stemmer, ons hou maar ons mond en betaal. Ons kruip weg in kampe, voor blind vir die rampe, en bid dat die Heer ons omhaal. Daar's Winnie Mandela, wat mense verbrand het, maar nou wil sy huil in haar hand. Staatskas is leeg en die ANC jeug saai verwoesting en pyn deur ons land. Gee vir my 'n nuwe gein, 'n koos toe plezier en 'n tellerij, wat liefkie sing en skry en stry oor die mooi van ons land en ons reg om hier te kan bly. Waar sy kinders, sy kinders kan bly. Maar sy huis en sy lande is nou in die hande van die vyand teen wie hy moes stry. Ons kinders verstaan nie, waar kom al vandaan nie, al erfenis is uitgewis. Geen volkslied of vlag nie, en geen ere wag nie vir die helde wat daar nie meer is. Gee vir my een nieuwe gein, een koos toe plezier en een tellerij, wat liefkie sing en skry, oor die mooi van ons land en ons reg om hier te kan bly. Gee vir my een nieuwe gein, een koos toe plezier en een tellerij, wat liefkie sing en skry, oor die mooi van ons land, en ons reg om hier te kan bly, en ons reg om hier te kan bly.
Welcome to Radio Free South Africa, coming to you on Resolution Radio. I'd like to give a big shout out to Sunny and his crew for inviting Radio Free South Africa to be part of his network and giving us another platform to get our story out to an uncaring, silent world. This is your host, Karen Smith. Our introductory music is a song by Sunette Bridges, a great South African patriot and a fighter for the white people in South Africa. The song, translated into English, means enough. Enough of the rape, the murder, the farm murders, the destruction of our heritage and our history in South Africa. It is a cry from the heart of every single white person in South Africa. South Africa. Our listeners must realize that we are 8 hours behind South Africa. So at this time in South Africa, it is about 3 o'clock in the morning, and a very hard time to ask for a South African guest to be wide awake, bushy-tailed, and ready to talk. So, our great friend, Kuan Elgin, the writer of the book Kbulala, which means kill, has written for us a piece for me for this opening program. I always feel that it is important to understand where you have come from in order to know where you are going to. So this is a very short history of South Africa. Our call-in number is 607-203-5423, and we welcome any questions or comments from listeners. So, Who is the Afrikaner? By Kuan Elgin. The history of the Afrikaner in South Africa stretches back over 360 years. Yet they are now, due to the political developments of the past few decades, mistakenly regarded by much of the rest of the world as newcomers or even as foreigners in this, the land of their birth, and the land of the birth of their forefathers, their beloved country. People whose parents have settled in any other country of the world are considered natives and citizens of those foreign lands in which they are born, after only one generation. Yet this right has seemingly been withheld from the Afrikaners of South Africa, though they have been there for at least 10 generations. Although my own mother tongue is English, I speak Afrikaans on a daily basis and consider myself a man of Africa, born and bred. Technically, it is only really those whose native tongue or home language is Afrikaans who are Afrikaners. Currently, anyone of originally European extraction who now considers themselves to be a white African can be regarded, if they so wish, as an Afrikaner. Especially, of course, those whose home language is Afrikaans and who identify with the Afrikaner Boer culture and traditions. However, in my own estimation, based upon my half century of life experience, much of it spent living and working in South Africa, those who call themselves Afrikaners have rarely been portrayed in an altogether honest light, even by many of our white cousins abroad. Some in our kindred Christian European descended nations may have been motivated to present this inaccurate image out of genuine concern for the welfare of other ethnic Africans. However, many have also been motivated by less altruistic reasons, such as the modern liberal notion of political correctness, which is ever-changing, and will hopefully one day be disregarded and treated with the disdain which it so rightfully deserves. White South Africans are sometimes confusingly referred to as Europeans, which they are not anymore, Afrikaners, or Boers, or even Afrikaner Boers. To simplistically explain the difference, if there is one, would be to say that the original Cape settlers were the forebears of the Afrikaners, and those who left the Cape and trekked into the vast, largely unoccupied interior were Trek Boers, who eventually settled and established the two Boer republics of the Transvaal, the ZAR, or South African Republic, and the Orange Free State in the mid-1800s. Nonetheless, they are one and the same people, and if there does exist any division, it is between those regarded as English-speaking and Afrikaans-speaking white South Africans, although both groups generally can converse quite easily in the other's tongue. The first permanent white settlers in South Africa were the Dutch, who envisaged establishing a refreshment and resupply station for their ships rounding the Cape of Good Hope, en route to the east in search of trade. They founded Cape Town, then Kaapstad, within a year of the founding of New York, then New Amsterdam. Added to the original Dutch settlers were German, Flemish, Scandinavian, and in 1688, around 200 French Huguenot families escaping religious persecution in Europe. After a period of time, employees of this Dutch East India Company were permitted to farm for their own income in the surrounding areas, so long as they sold their produce to the company at prices fixed by the company. Caller from the 937 area, you're live on air. Hello, caller from the 937 area. They obviously don't want to speak to us, or maybe they're just listening. Welcome, and I'm glad to see you're here. Then, from 1820, while the country was under later British governance, many English, Scots, Welsh, and Irish families arrived to settle and farm on the Eastern Cape frontier. They were essentially brought in to form a buffer between the southernmost Bantu tribe, the Warlike and Indolent Khoza, and the white settlements in the Cape. Despite this growing mix of many cultures and languages, the language of law and commerce in South Africa remained Dutch, which eventually evolved into the hybrid that is today known as Afrikaans, a language that could roll and roar like an African thunderstorm echoing off the cliffs, or whisper and sing like the wind through the acacias. Thus, the only white African tribes, the Afrikaner Boers, have been farming the land in South Africa as long as have the citizens of the United States of America. How ridiculous it would seem to demand that they, the Americans, hand back their land to the original inhabitants. Yet that is precisely what is now being demanded of the farmers, Boers, of South Africa. It must also be clearly stated that blacks were not the original inhabitants of what is now South Africa. In fact, wandering black herders were moving south into the region at around the same time in history as wandering white herders, Afrikaner trekboers, were steadily moving northwards from their settlement in the Cape. It was only a century and a half after Cape Town had been established that the white pioneers first met and then later clashed with the black tribes that had begun to settle in the northeast of the country. Thus, all the people of South Africa are settlers, and no group has more or less claim to the land than any other. Historically, hello, caller from the 937 area. You are live online. Welcome to Radio Free South Africa.
Hello, Corinne. This is Sunny.
Hi, Sunny. Welcome to the show, and thank you so very, very much for giving Radio Free South Africa this platform to tell our story.
Yes, I very much enjoyed when you were a fill-in host on my show, and I learned so much from you every time, not only of the bureaucratic makework that goes down there, but also just the outright atrocities that are happening to the white people, and not to mention the fact that just the people of South Africa just can't seem to get along with a corrupt government in place. And just more and more people start to learn about this, and why the UN is completely mute on the topic now that communist Nelson Mandela is gone. Nobody gives a damn about South Africa, and I think that's really disgusting because, by definition, genocide is taking place down there in that nation. So I'm very happy to have you on our radio network, and looking forward to hearing your commentary and any guests you bring on, because of the fact that you've shown me over and over again that not only do you have a passion for what you do, but you actually have a talent for what you do. So very much welcome to Resolution Radio.
Thank you so very, very much, Sunny. As you know yourself, being a show host is not the fun it's made out to be. It's incredibly hard work. But in my case, it is so worthwhile, because I was coming to the point where I was going to say that in my 5 years in the USA, I have not found anybody else who is willing, able, or has been given a platform to speak about the atrocities in South Africa. So the burden on my shoulders is heavy, but I think that I'm passionate and committed enough to carry that burden until somebody comes along to share it.
Oh, very much so. And like I said, just talking to Brandy Richards about a year and a half ago and hearing her activism and some of the stuff that she's seen firsthand was really an eye-opener. And then hearing your additional commentary, going into how much detail, really, how difficult it is to even get to the United States, much less try to get out of your own nation, was horrific enough. But I can seriously understand why people are literally jumping the fences because of the fact it's so much bureaucratic make-work to even get into this country legally. I can see why everybody's breaking the law. I don't justify it. I don't agree with it. But I understand the reasons why they're tempted to do so.
Well, you know, sunny South African, white South Africans, are the most law-abiding, gentle in the world. They would make such a contribution to the U.S. economy. They do not believe in living off anybody else. They believe in self-responsibility, in taking care of themselves, in working hard to make something of their lives. And yet, because of this awful stigma of apartheid, as you call it here, they are just not welcome anywhere in the world. And that, to me, is such a travesty, because we're allowing these Syrians, these Islamic hordes, to flow into every single white country in the world and create devastation, destruction, rape, looting, murder, burning, wherever they go. And yet these gentle, hardworking, God-fearing people are not welcome anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely atrocity what's going on there. But I mean, just like what's going on between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's like when Palestinians step up and want to talk about it, the media just totally blurs them out. But poor Israel, poor little Israel is always inundated with stuff. Well, arguably, you might have less problems with your neighbors if you weren't such a prick. I mean, that's pretty much how I look at it. So what I find really atrocious in that case is if a kid throws a rock, they throw rockets back into the kid's neighborhood. That's where they're seriously a problem. And at least last year, or a year and a half ago, on Facebook, finally there was a big push to stand up for Gaza and start bringing to light the atrocities that the Israeli government is doing to the people of Palestine.
Well, Sunny, that's exactly what the ANC government is doing in South Africa. They're not quite firing rockets at them, but they are destroying them, black and white alike. They are destroying them. The black unemployment rate in South Africa is over 52%. Now, wow. What does one expect that those uneducated, disillusioned, unemployed, and unemployable blacks are doing with their days? They are stealing, looting, burning schools, burning government buildings, burning tires, necklacing people, murdering farmers, and it all with the government not uplifting the people as they promised in 1994.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll definitely let you take the reins, and you're the navigator, so lash your hands onto the helm and go out and face that storm at sea, Corinne, because I'm very much looking forward to hearing your program.
Great, Sunny. Thank you very much for calling in, and thank you once again from a very grateful people, because I have had many messages from South Africa saying thank the hosts and thank me for spreading the word, because people in South Africa don't have the freedom to do it. They would not live very long if they did it. And B, because once they're out of there, they feel safe. They don't want to think about it, and so they keep quiet. And neither side do I blame. But it's just someone has to do it. Someone happened to be me.
I have to give props first to the technology known as Twitter, and then after that I have to give credit where it counts, which is Natasha, who I follow on Twitter now for the last couple of years. And then when I went to bring her on as a guest on my show, she directed me to you because she was afraid her English wasn't very good. And then from that particular point on, just opened up a huge door of meeting all sorts of wonderful people and all sorts of interesting guests to bring on and to really spotlight the genocide that's going on in South Africa.
Well, once again, Sunny, thank you very much for taking our cause to your heart and for helping us.
I just want to give props to Natasha where it belongs.
Yeah, Natasha is an incredible, incredible, tireless patriot. I don't think she ever sleeps. She is always on Facebook, on Twitter, on her blog. She is always somewhere with the latest news from South Africa. She is one incredibly strong, brave lady. But as you say, she does not want to go on air.
Yeah, I retweet her stuff at all hours of the day and night, too. So, and she always gives me props for doing it. So, I make additional comment to the post. But yeah, that's how I first came across, and that's just turned into a really wonderful relationship. So I've got to know some really wonderful people. So I'll hop off of here and let you take the helm and full speed ahead.
Thank you again, Sonny.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. So we were talking about the history of South Africa written by that great South African author, Kuan Elgin. Historically, the only peoples who could truly be considered to be original inhabitants of South Africa were very different from the blacks who now claim all of the land for themselves. These aboriginals were small, scattered, Stone Age clans of Khoi Khoi, nicknamed Hottentots, and Khoi San, called Bushmen, who wandered into the area long before either whites or blacks did. Their origins are uncertain, and they display unique racial characteristics. The Khoi Khoi tribes, nomadic herders, possessed long-horned cattle and fat-tailed sheep and lived in portable hide tents, whereas the tiny sand bushmen, or Khoi San, with their deadly poison-tipped arrows, hunted the vast herds of plains game on the veldt of the drier interior. They painted evocative and inspirational hunting scenes in their caves and even contrived some moving poetry in their sing-song, clicking language. However, they occasionally clashed with the somewhat taller, more advanced, but similar-looking Khoi Khoi herders. The sand bushmen considered the domesticated livestock of the Khoi Khoi herders as fair game, and, since it was simply more easily hunted, they freely helped themselves to it. Warlike Nguni-speaking Negroid tribes were slowly migrating southwards, ever southwards from West, Central, and East Africa. Having learned iron working from the skilled Arab traders of ivory, gold, and slaves, these Bantu possessed better weapons than the original inhabitants of Southern Africa, the initial Khoi San and subsequent Khoi Khoi tribes. These Bantu were also taller and darker, as well as more muscular and robust than either of those original tribes, which the Bantu considered vastly inferior to themselves. The Bantu did, however, prize the Khoi women as concubines. The Bantu, like the Khoi, brought cattle, sheep, goats, and dogs along with them. However, they had yet to discover the wheel and had no written language, and they lived in crude grass and mud huts. The Bantu hunted game with spears or by driving herds into pits or over cliffs and gathered felt vegetables and herbs. But they also grew a few crops when they settled long enough at any particular suitably fertile location, often employing slash-and-burn agricultural practices. They built nothing of any substance and were ruled mostly by brutal despots who thought nothing of slaughtering their own people on a whim. Ironically, Shaka Zulu, who founded the Zulu nation in the early 1800s, they were unheard of before this, a minor clan. He cleared much of the interior of South Africa by his genocidal raids on the surrounding tribes. This left the field open for the Afrikaner Boers to trek into those devastated areas and begin settling and building farms and towns. The Bantu tribes did not remain long in any particular region, but soon again moved on, ever southwards, in their quest for new and greener pastures. They regularly preyed upon any weaker neighbors, stealing their crops and herds, enslaving their womenfolk, and killing off the men, or forcefully assimilating them into their own armies. Today, the original Khoi and San have been assimilated by and have inbred with the many other peoples of South Africa, and now mostly call themselves coloureds, and speak Afrikaans, as opposed to any Bantu and Nguni language. Only in isolated places in the Kalahari Desert can one find scattered bands of almost pure-blooded Bushmen, some of whom are now enslaved to the Herero and Ovambo tribes of Namibia, formerly Southwest Africa. The Boer republics fought two wars against imperialistic Britain. The first, in 1881, was more of a series of sharp battles, which the Boers easily won, and thereby forced Britain to recognize their independence. The second was a much longer and much bloodier affair, lasting from 1899 to 1902. This war, which pitted some 50,000 Boer commandos against 10 times that many British and colonial troops, would devastate the country. Britain's aim was not, as she declared, to ensure democratic rights for foreigners in the South African Republic, but to steal their enormous mineral wealth of gold and diamonds. To do so, Britain adopted a barbaric scorched earth policy of burning over 60,000 Boer farms and interning some 120,000 Boer women and children in squalorous concentration camps, in which around 30,000 civilians, mostly children, died. The British also shipped captured Boers to faraway prison camps in Barbados, India, Ceylon, and on St. Helena Island. When the Boers were finally forced to capitulate, they were a ruined people. It took more than 40 years for them to rebuild their nation to the point where they could finally govern themselves again. And in the following 40 years, they developed South Africa into a modern powerhouse. Unfortunately, their policy of sidelining the black population from meaningful participation in national government and of separating the races as a government policy made them many enemies in the outside world, and the die was then cast. A true account of the history of South Africa will reveal to the reader other sinister motivations behind the desire of some people to demonize the Afrikaner. The current rulers of this land that we love have also tampered with the proud Afrikaner history, removing from modern books and periodicals a long list of achievements, or even falsely claiming these accomplishments as their own. They have painted a new, rather distorted picture of Afrikaner history to serve a sometimes disingenuous and often hostile agenda, deliberately ignoring the many virtuous achievements of our forefathers and embellishing instead those aspects which their liberal and thus largely anti-Afrikaner readership preferred to read and believe. Some journalists within the liberal, or perhaps misinformed, media of other nations have themselves believed, usually without doing any factual research of their own, much of the negative propaganda that has been churned out against the Afrikaner. Thus, many journalists are guilty of unscholarly or even sometimes dishonest journalism, which has resulted from their unwarranted prejudice against the Afrikaner. Prejudice means to prejudge, or judge before considering the evidence, or to form a judgment after considering the evidence from one side alone. Unwarranted prejudice against the Afrikaner people is the result of not considering historical facts before drawing biased opinions and conclusions. The old motto of the scholarly Welsh Druidic priests has as much relevance today as it has centuries ago: the truth against the world. Jesus Christ himself declared, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." The early attempts of the Afrikaner people to carve their own place in the African sun, and the subsequent attempts of their descendants to retain that place in a land which is often, behind its unrivaled natural beauty, harsh and unforgiving, are often viewed negatively by the rest of the world, even though the methods employed by the Afrikaner people were not unique to world events. At times, the Afrikaners felt it necessary to employ seemingly heavy-handed methods to preserve what they had given their lives to establish, methods which may modernly be perceived as politically incorrect. Yet again, these methods were not unique to world history and have been practiced by many peoples in most nations to preserve their own distinct national identity. However, the methods employed by the early Afrikaner pioneers were seldom as harsh as those used by many other African tribes against each other and against the Afrikaners themselves. It also needs to be realized that Africa is not a civilized land, and it never has been, though I sincerely pray that it does one day become so. The old adage, drastic times call for drastic measures, has never been more true than when applied to the history of the Afrikaner in South Africa. Their ancestors were tough, uncompromising men and women, but they held fast to their biblical beliefs and eschewed the different opinions of those they considered worldly or liberal. An objective observer would have to admit that the measures employed by Afrikaners at times pale in comparison to the barbaric measures frequently and casually employed against them, even sometimes by kindred nations. Further, the nations of Europe themselves employed those same methods against the other peoples of Africa whenever it suited their political or economic agendas. Yet the Afrikaner people have been unforgivably vilified, in reality, often for only defending themselves, which is a basic human right. To give an outside perspective, it would be useful to consider the assessment of the Afrikaner Boers by the famous British author Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the following after serving as a medic in the Anglo-Boer War of 1899 to 1902. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, a well-educated and perceptive man, was, of course, the inventor of the equally famous but fictitious detective Sherlock Holmes. This is an abridged version. The Boer, by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, from Chapter 1 of his book, The Great Boer War. Take a community of Dutchmen of the type of those who defended themselves for 50 years against all the power of Spain at a time when Spain was the greatest power in the world. Intermix them with a strain of those inflexible French Huguenots who gave up their name and fortune and left their country forever at the time of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. The product must, obviously, be one of the most rugged, versatile, unconquerable races ever seen upon earth. Take these formidable people and train them for seven generations in constant warfare against savage men and ferocious beasts in circumstances in which no weakling could survive. Place them so that they acquire skill with weapons and in horsemanship. Give them a country which is eminently suited to the tactics of the huntsman, the marksman, and the rider. Then, finally, put a fine temper upon their military qualities by a dour, fatalistic Old Testament religion and an ardent and consuming patriotism. Combine all these qualities and these impulses in one individual, and you have the modern Boer. I also urge all readers to pursue further study of their own by reading reliable books which cover the real history of the old South Africa, rather than merely accepting the repeatedly revised, official, politically correct versions presented modernly, unless one prefers fantasy over reality. In my book, Bulala, A True Story of South Africa, I have placed the facts on the table, in most cases without personal comment, and have thus left it to the reader to draw his or her own conclusions. Even the godless Friedrich Nietzsche noted, "The majority of men prefer delusion to truth. It soothes, it is easy to grasp. Above all, it fits more snugly than the truth into a universe of false appearances." Similarly, Leo Tolstoy astutely recognized, "Shallow ideas can be assimilated. Ideas that require people to reorganize their picture of the world provoke hostility. I know that most men, including those at ease with problems of the greatest complexity, can seldom accept even the simplest and most obvious truth, if it be such as would oblige them to admit the falsity of conclusion, which they have delighted in explaining to colleagues, which they proudly talk to others, and which they have woven thread by thread into the fabric of their lives. Only by doing objective study from the traditional view, and then comparing it to the modern version, can anyone truly understand the factual history of the Afrikaner nation, as well as the real reasons behind modern ethnic tensions and stereotypes. For instance, the name Afrikaner is often synonymous with apartheid, which means separateness. The liberal Western world would turn against the South African Republic and its proud tribe of white, Afrikaans, and English-speaking pioneers. Much of the West also turned a deaf ear to any South Africaner attempts to explain why apartheid was a necessary institution to preserve the integrity of their white, Christian, African Republic. Though no one listened, the Afrikaners explained why apartheid was mandatory. The Afrikaners themselves refused to live or behave like the black Africans. It was required to maintain law, order, and safety, and to preserve their Christian civilization. It was necessary to preserve the racial integrity of the white Christian hegemony of their republic. This in itself was certainly no crime, for all non-white races demanded the same basic right. The Afrikaners refused to be governed by the black Africans, who had consistently opposed them, blacks who had supported an imperialistic invader, Britain, against them, blacks whose moral standards were far different than their own, and because God had commanded it in his word. The Afrikaners refused to allow their independent republic to revert to barbarism, as all other European colonies in Africa had done, once they succumbed to black majority rule. Even though their republics were never really British colonies, the Afrikaners had existed autonomously before the British came and stole their nation from them. However, the wind of change was sweeping through Africa as a virulent liberalism was raging through the West. The propaganda of the liberal press and libertine Hollywood moguls would hold a monopoly over impressionable minds. The mythical, noble black savage would be exalted and welcomed with open arms into many European countries, bringing with him a pagan religion, lower standards, and many new vices. Rather than enjoying true civilization, the black African seemingly set about to destroy it by corrupting its institutions. Yet, despite his apparently irreparable harm to white Christian civilization, he received and continues to receive nothing but praise from the liberal media and Western governments. On the other hand, the white Africans, the builders of the only true modern civilization in Africa, who brought peace, safety, and prosperity wherever they settled, would be vilified and become the social pariahs of the world. South Africa, which had already seceded from the British Commonwealth of Nations, was soon expelled from the very United Nations that it helped to establish. Crippling, discriminatory international economic, sporting, and military sanctions would be enforced against South Africa for their crime against humanity, which is what the UN declared apartheid to be. For wanting to preserve what was theirs by the unflinching practice of their own traditional religious and political beliefs within the borders of their own nation. The white Afrikaners were not guilty of telling other nations how they ought to live, nor were they guilty of oppressing other weaker nations around them. Their crime was desiring to preserve the integrity of their own institutions and their own nation. International demands for democracy in the white Afrikaner-ruled nation would grow ever more strident. Yet, hypocritically, these same liberal nations studiously ignored the glaring fact that 90% of black African-ruled countries themselves were not democratic, and that not a single Arab-ruled African nation was either. Yet, the white African tribe endured and even prospered against all these odds, becoming self-sufficient and self-reliant. They developed a nuclear capability and also the world's first viable oil from coal facility. They were front runners in many fields, such as agriculture, science, engineering, aeronautics, advanced weapons and guidance systems, deep-level mining, wildlife conservation, higher education, and medical research. In fact, the world's first heart transplant was performed in 1967 by Dr. Christiaan Neertling Barnard. The South African rand was considerably stronger than even the US dollar, and the standard of living of all South Africans, including the blacks, was easily the highest in Africa and was amongst the highest in the world. Yet, even within the whites' own ranks, there were those, mostly English-speaking or Jewish, who joined militant black liberation movements and rallied support in the West for these organizations. The whites of South Africa, abandoned by the rest of the world, then developed the best-equipped and most modern army in the Southern Hemisphere to protect their new republic's borders against a violent wave of communist-armed and trained black liberation armies building up to their north, also supported by many of the nations of Christendom. Young white men and boys would give their lives in defense of their beloved country to protect their farms and homes, their parents and siblings, and their wives and children. In the land of their birth, their Afrikaner homeland, for 3.5 centuries, they would endure the violent and bloody birth pangs of black consciousness, then face an internal rising tide of black terrorism, well armed and encouraged from abroad. As a result, anarchy would soon stalk their once safe streets and then ravage their productive, peaceful farms, held back only by the efficiencies of the centuries-old rural commando units. Black students crying freedom before education would burn to the ground their own schools, civic buildings, clinics, and infrastructure which the whites had built for them, and even cut down the avenues of trees which the whites had planted for them, calling them symbols of colonial oppression. They would burn alive, utilizing their horrific diesel-filled rubber tie necklaces, even those of their own people suspected of being collaborators with the whites. They would brutally murder innocent white civilians, even white teachers and nurses who had devoted their lives to the service and upliftment of blacks. The ANC, African National Congress, communist-trained militant wing of this black liberation struggle, was a group called Mkhonto weSizwe, MK, meaning the spear of the nation. This liberationist organization would torture and execute hundreds of blacks within their own camps in the frontline states: Angola, Botswana, Mozambique, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe, who they suspected of being traitors. This declared terrorist group, based in the north of the White Republic, planted landmines on South African farm roads and detonated limpet mines and car bombs in peaceful towns, indiscriminately killing and maiming innocent civilians, both black and white. Yet they never actually confronted the white army in South Africa in battle. In the frontline state of Angola, most of the real fighting against the whites was done for the black liberation forces by 50,000 Cuban troops, outfitted with Russian tanks and MiG fighter aircraft, which culminated in a stalemate at the hard-fought battle of Quetta Quinivale in October of 1987. The Sandbushmen of Namibia, the original inhabitants of that desert land, many of whom have acted as trackers for the South African army, were dispossessed of half their allotted homeland there by the incoming black government as a punishment for that allegiance. Notably, Many moderate black Namibian troops also fought alongside the white troops against the Marxist-led and Cuban-backed infiltrators from Angola, the Ovambo, who now have a majority in the new Namibian government. Yet still, the strongly Christian white African nation endured, preferring to live as an independent ethnic minority under virtual siege, declared an enemy of the world, than to capitulate to communist-backed black majority rule and turn their backs on their God and their very heritage. The apartheid era itself would last a mere 40 years, one generation, considerably less than the 70 years that the people of Eastern Europe suffered under the heel of communism. Yet, the white Afrikaners reasoned apartheid was not some foreign institution imposed upon some other nation, as was the case with communism. It was essentially the house rules of a sovereign people established to maintain law and order in their own nation. The primary reason apartheid was instituted was the absolute refusal of the whites to have blacks living permanently within their towns and suburbs. Seeing how the fast-breeding blacks lived in their own villages and obeying God's command to be separate, the Afrikaners legislated apartheid to preserve the integrity and safety of their own nation and people. Further, the Afrikaners, being a Christian people, would not allow dark arts practicing ancestor worshippers to live among them, since centuries of missionary efforts, they argued, had produced no real moral advancement or notable spiritual change in the majority of the black peoples of South Africa. Yet, the albatross of infamy engendered by the legacy of apartheid would forever be dredged up by the incoming ANC to stigmatize and discriminate against all whites, and to then justify the passing of legislation to dispossess skilled white South Africans of their jobs and white farmers of their land, even 2 decades after the whites themselves had abolished the policy of apartheid. Hypocritically, the black government now began to impose racially discriminatory legislation against the 8.5% ethnic minority whites. But now that the tables had been turned, such racial discrimination was considered to be a good thing. This duplicity is the modus operandi that international communists have ever employed in their attempts to undermine all sovereign Christian nations. It is alleged that communistic and thus atheistic liberals put the white Christians on a contrived guilt trip by declaring their segregationist attitude and practices to be un-Christian and even immoral. A wedge is thus driven in amongst society to weaken it from within, divide and conquer. Once legislative concessions have been made and all have been declared political equals, then the masses of non-whites democratically outvote the white Christians in their own lands. Once the non-whites hold the power, the very same so-called oppressive, discriminatory, racist laws, which the Fabianized liberals declared to be immoral, are then re-legislated against the white Christian minority in their own land. Since only the nations of Christendom have stood in the way of communist world domination, all white Christian nations have purposely been weakened and some destroyed in this fashion. Before the 20th century drew to a close, however, the status quo in the Republic of South Africa would change dramatically. An Afrikaner lawyer named F.W. Frederick Willem de Klerk would become president of South Africa. He was a leader within the conservative circles of the nation who had espoused traditional views concerning segregation. However, once he became president, he incomprehensibly made a 180-degree change in his philosophy. And in his first speech, he tried to convince his own people that they should share power with the black masses. De Klerk, called by some a Volksverraaier, a folk betrayer, lifted the ban on the ANC, which had been considered a terrorist group, and released its leaders, including Nelson Mandela, from prison. Gullible liberal whites were beguiled into believing that a democratically elected black majority government composed of those who had objected so violently to being discriminated against on the grounds of their race would be fair once elected. These liberal whites were soon rudely awakened to the reality of race once the blacks, upon gaining power, vengefully reimposed many of those very same discriminatory laws against the tiny white minority. Many of those, again, mostly English-speaking or Jewish liberals, left the country soon after coming to this belated realization. A new, rapacious black government was swept into power by an overwhelmingly black majority vote. An autocratic black regime then, for the first time ever in Afrikaner history, would begin to rule over and then legislate against the whites in the whites' own country. A country which they had transformed from an untamed wilderness with their blood, sweat, and tears into a veritable utopia. Many common blacks would then also begin to take their own brutal perceived revenge on those whom they considered their former oppressors, all white people. During the very first decades of black majority rule, violent black criminals would brutally torture, burn, shoot, and hack to death thousands of peaceful white farmers, savagely violate their wives and daughters, and even brutally murder many of the white people's faithful black and colored workers. These rural whites could no longer rely upon the protection of the voluntary white commandos because the ANC had disarmed and outlawed them as white supremacist groups. Merciless black criminals, unopposed, would also begin killing innocent white civilians in their own homes, in their towns, and in the cities. Yet not a single black South African politician, nor even a single white liberal politician, previously so vocal in condemning the unjust treatment of blacks, would utter a word of protest against or condemnation of the slaughter of innocent people. Not only was this obviously immoral, it was foolish and even suicidal, for they were allowing the genocide of the Afrikaner Boers, the farmers, the very food producers of their country, the very backbone of the rural areas. But the world, even the Christian world, would turn a blind eye to the blacks in their ethnic cleansing of white Christian Afrikaners. And the world continues to turn a blind eye to this day. Yet the growing black masses would depend for their very lives upon the infrastructure and farms painstakingly built by those hardy white African pioneers, both Afrikaner Boer and British. Sadly, these two European people, kinsmen, had been set on a collision path laid 2 centuries earlier and then reinforced a century later by hidden powers, so they would destroy one another. The Boers and the British did not realize that the real enemies of their civilization stood impatiently on the sidelines, like hyenas, watching and waiting for their own chance to grasp the reins of power and divide the spoil. When the dust finally settled, South Africa would be under the leadership of a wily Khoza-Loya who had been jailed for sabotage and for trying to start a race war. The name of that Khoza-Loya was, of course, the famous Nelson Mandela. His second name colloquially means troublemaker, or he who shakes the tree. During South Africa's post-apartheid war crimes tribunal, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, chaired by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, it was revealed that while the white apartheid regime had murdered just over 500 of their mainly black political opponents, the ANC-dominated black liberation movement had murdered over 22,000 of their own mainly black political opponents. Mandela was eventually freed from prison, largely as a result of British interference and pressure from liberals in other Western nations. Despite still professing the belief that violence was a legitimate political tool to wrest the government and the nation from the whites. Though Mandela claimed to espouse democracy when it was to his benefit as a sure means of gaining power in South Africa, he consistently criticized the leaders of Western democracies, while his close personal friends included people such as Cuban dictator Fidel Castro, Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. After lengthy negotiations to share power with a black majority under a new constitution, which was the only mandate that a majority of the white electorate had given their leader, de Klerk and his henchmen ignored pleas, as did the mainstream press, from Afrikaners to establish a toevlug in die Weste, a refuge in the West, in the historically white Western Cape. Afrikaners were demanding their own state, or, at the very least, a federation of states, wherein they could exercise a degree of self-determination. But the de Klerk team suddenly capitulated to the black negotiators and agreed to a universal franchise vote. This basically guaranteed that the ANC would easily and overwhelmingly win the election and then wield absolute power. The ANC swiftly began bussing in tens of thousands of causes from their Eastern Cape homeland to the cities, and especially to Cape Town, establishing sprawling squatter camps there to ensure that they would have sufficient loyal voters ready to swing the elections their way. It is a common misconception that the ANC's leader in these early elections, Nelson Mandela, had been jailed for his political beliefs. He was, in fact, acquitted of treason after a four-year trial, but re-arrested a few years later and sentenced to 5 years imprisonment for launching an armed insurrection as founder and commander-in-chief of MK, the ANC's militant wing. He was then later charged with 193 counts of terrorism for sabotage and for trying to smuggle, prepare, or manufacture mostly Soviet bloc munitions, including 210,000 hand grenades, 48,000 anti-personnel mines, 144 tons of ammonium nitrate, 21.6 tons of aluminium powder, 1,500 timing devices, and 2,000 pounds of black gunpowder. Among his many alleged co-conspirators were three communist Jews, Dennis Goldberg, Arthur Goldreich, and Lionel Rusty Bernstein. Nelson Mandela's personal Makarov pistol for killing white policemen, which he buried in Rivonia before his arrest during the ANC's armed struggle, was never recovered. It is time for a station check. We will be back after a few minutes to continue with the history of South Africa written by our great friend and marvelous author, Ewan Elgin.
Visit Infowars.com and PrisonPlanet.com. When you're on the site, you can also tune in 24 hours a day to my daily radio broadcast. There's also a free iPhone app to listen to the syndicated radio show when and where you want.
Imagine a school where faith and integrity are at its center, where heritage and responsibility instill character, where educating both hearts and minds brings about academic excellence. There is a school in American Fork where character and embracing the providence of a living God are fundamental, where students' national test scores average near the 90th percentile. Based on LDS principles and a love of country, now in our 39th year, American Heritage School is accepting fall enrollment for kindergarten through high school. What would you do for your child? Give them an education that will prepare them for life located east of the temple in American Fork, American Heritage School is a remarkable and affordable alternative. Visit us, find us online, or in the Yellow Pages, American Heritage School in American Fork.
We fought, we learned, we struggled, we won. Despite Obama's best efforts, the newspaper of the human resistance survives. We have lived only to face a new nightmare, the war against the machines. Read about our struggle in The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. The Sovereign is a 24-page monthly tabloid newspaper about the war between man and machines. We've tried reason, we've tried legislation. We've tried every peaceful means imaginable, and all it's gotten us is shut out. So now we fight the machines. Order online today at thesovnews.com or find The Sovereign at select newsstands. Remember to read The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. The human resistance's battle against the machines will be everlasting. This is mercy. It was never our destiny to stop the age of Obama. It was merely to survive it. Together. Together.
Restore the Republic, the social network for the modern revolutionary. Activating the silent masses into action. At RestoreTheRepublic.net, we're seizing power from the globalist world controllers and handing it back to the people. RestoreTheRepublic.net, where patriots rally on the objective. The Liberty Bell tolls once again for a movement on the rise. Make RestoreTheRepublic.net your place to unify and activate the revolution.
Hands.
You're listening to Radio Free South Africa, coming to you on Resolution Radio. We've been listening to Children of Ham by Tattoo Billy. Tattoo Billy is a great, great supporter of the White South African cause, and we thank him for his permission to use his music. We were talking about Nelson Mandela. These were clearly not trumped-up political charges. In his eloquent closing statement to the court, Mandela candidly admitted his guilt on the charge of sabotage, adding that he was, if needs be, prepared to die for his ideals. It was apparent from the huge amount of smuggled explosives that he was not planning to die alone. Nelson Mandela was sentenced to life imprisonment, not summarily executed, as he undoubtedly would have been in any black African country at that time for the same offenses. Some made fanciful comparisons with the fate of plotter Guy Fawkes, who was burned at the stake for his failed attempt to blow up the British Parliament in 1605. However, Mandela conspired not just to bring down the government. He was planning on killing tens of thousands of innocent civilians in his quest for power. The judge at his trial did in fact comment that personal ambition may well have played a role in his plans. Mandela boldly admitted his guilt. He was never tortured during either his interrogation or incarceration, as he undoubtedly would have been in a black nation. In fact, he was generally treated humanely by his white captors, eventually being transferred from Robben Island to the mainland and living comfortably in a cottage in the grounds of the prison for the latter part of his incarceration. During this time, Nelson Mandela wrote a dissertation titled How to Be a Good Communist. Although he was approached and offered an early release by then-President Pieter Willem Botha in the mid-1980s, Mandela still steadfastly refused to renounce his commitment to violence. Likewise, even when he eventually gained an early release by F.W. de Klerk about 6 years later, on the condition that he commit his party to peaceful negotiations, he still refused to renounce violence. As he walked free from the prison grounds, accompanied by his second wife, Winnie Madikizela Mandela, he raised his fist in a black power salute. Further, in the first speech he made as a free man, he brazenly announced that the armed struggle would continue. The rest, as they say, is history. Nelson Mandela subsequently led his communist-aligned ANC to an overwhelming victory in the first fully democratic South African elections in 1994. One of their favorite chants at political rallies to this day is Bulala Amabunu, kill the Boer. The Afrikaner Boers, as people of the book, who they believe themselves to be, live by the book. As they answer to God and not to men, they consider themselves duty-bound to keep themselves separate from other races and believe themselves to be justified in so doing. They have a wry sense of humor and an endearing old-school manner. It should again be noted that racial exclusiveness within a nation is nothing unusual, and it is not a phenomenon found merely among white nations. No other people on the face of the earth, except European peoples, automatically grants to dissimilar foreigners the status of equality and a voice in the government. Even today, in China, Arab nations, Israel, India, and black African nations, white Christians are never automatically extended equality or any right to have a say in how those nations are governed. It is only natural and proper that all nations retain their own sovereignty and preserve the integrity of their people. However, hypocritically, these principles of equality are not applied consistently. It also should be remembered that the Afrikaners did not invade established metropolises of black Africa and then take over. The Afrikaners themselves built those cities out of uninhabited wastelands and developed them, to which the blacks later flocked to partake of the benefits of civilization. All the Afrikaners have ever really wanted is to rule themselves on their own land. That is as true today as it has ever been. Let it be. It behooves them then, as an honest, God-fearing, law-abiding people, rather than trying to erase the less admirable aspects of their individual histories, to study history as it was. Only by studying and accepting the reality of the past are we able to recognize any questionable actions of our ancestors, and then use that knowledge to rise above their mistakes and thus not follow in their sometimes faulty footsteps. Sadly, Winston Churchill, who was captured in South Africa during the Anglo-Boer War, observed, "The history of mankind is the history of war." The famous Irishman and British statesman Edmund Burke declared, "Those who fail to learn from history are destined to repeat it." May we all, by looking in the mirror of history, see the reality of the times reflected from the past, so that we can consciously choose a better reality for ourselves and for our children in the generations still to come. And a great, great vote of thanks to Kewan Elgin for writing that for us and for his incredible historical knowledge of what happened in South Africa. He will be a guest on this program at some very, very soon date, I hope. But as I said in the opening, it is 3 o'clock in the morning in South Africa to expect those people to be bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and ready to tell us the history of their country is a bit unfair of us. However, the true patriots in South Africa are willing to get up and speak to us at any time that suits us in order to help to get the word out about what is happening in South Africa. Now, we talk often of a white genocide happening in South Africa, and there seems to be an incredible misunderstanding of what a genocide is. So there is an article in This Is Europa, "What is White Genocide? A Thorough Explanation." White genocide is a term that is receiving greater attention lately in media and in online communities, but not everyone fully understands its meaning. We have written an article that touches upon this subject, but this article aims to explain this term in more detail in order to provide a better understanding of the phenomenon of white genocide. But before we go on to define white genocide, let us take a look at the actual definition of genocide and how it came to be. The term genocide, which many of us take for granted today, actually did not exist before 1944, until it was coined by a man with the name of Raphael Lemkin. The purpose was to define violent crimes committed against various groups of people in our societies with the intent to cause harm to that specific group of people, as there was a growing need to articulate and define human rights after the events of World War II, and it became imperative to ensure the rights of individuals and groups alike. The word genocide has been quite effectively established since then, and today most people think they know the definition of genocide. Ask a person what it means, and they would most likely tell you that it is simply an act of killing a group of people with the purpose of destroying them with the means of violent bloodshed. However, the term is much more complex than that, which becomes clear if you actually read the definition as presented in the UN International Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. As stated in Article No. 2 in the Genocide Convention, in the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. A. Killing members of the group. B. Causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. D. Imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. And E. Forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. When reading the actual article, it becomes evident that there are several definitions within the term genocide. According to Lemkin, who is responsible for the legal definition of the word used today, it does not matter how you try to eliminate a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group of people, or even individuals belonging to such groups, as it is still regarded as genocide. Genocide does not necessarily mean the immediate destruction of a nation. It is intended to signify a coordinated plan of different actions aiming at the destruction of essential foundations of the life of national groups with the aim of annihilating the groups themselves. The objectives of such a plan would be the disintegration of the political and social institutions of culture, language, national feelings, religion, and the economic existence of national groups, and the destruction of the personal security, liberty, health, dignity, and even the lives of the individuals belonging to such groups. Yet most people are only familiar with point A, killing members of the group. This is the most common definition and is probably the only one most people are familiar with. But let's take a look at the other points as well in context to current global, not only South African, but global policies. If we look at Western countries, we can indeed see traces of point B, D, and not to mention C. Regarding point B, in Western white countries, the phenomenon of cultural Marxism has without doubt caused mental harm to our people. For generations, our people have been taught that we have a collective guilt as white people and that we are responsible for most of the world's problems in one way or another. We are encouraged to feel ashamed of ourselves and of our history and ancestry. We whites are the only ones that are told that we should be punished for historical acts of slavery or conquest, as if we are exclusively responsible for the past deeds of our ancestors, or were exclusively the only peoples on earth who committed such deeds in the past. Belief systems such as these have left our people brainwashed to be indifferent to our extinction. And today, many of our people suffer from anti-white mentality. As for point D, it can be argued that even this point is relevant today, considering the norm of free abortion. Today, it is not unusual for Western women to use abortion as a form of birth control. Regardless of what your opinions are on the matter, the results of this, as well as other factors, have led to a very low birth rate amongst us whites. Instead of having more children, we expect immigrants to replace our decreasing population and our diminishing workforce. In any case, it is the point C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, that is the main aspect of white genocide. If we observe what is happening in the Western world, we can witness that there is in fact a policy of non-stop massive third world immigration into all white countries and only white countries. These open border policies, which will lead to a white minority in our countries, combined with forced assimilation and legally forcing white areas to become more diverse, meaning less white people and a blended humanity in all and only white countries, is what qualifies it as white genocide, as defined by Article 2, Part C of the United Nations Genocide Conventions. Because these deliberate policies are inflicting our people conditions of life calculated to bring about our physical destruction in whole or in part. Are these policies really being enforced? Yes. I asked the very same question myself a few years ago, but once I started to look at the world map with this new perspective, it became evident that this is no coincidence. You see these policies being enforced in every Western country with a predominantly white population. They call it diversity and multiculturalism. But in reality, it is just nice sounding words to say open borders and less white people. You don't see any open border policy in China. You don't hear anyone demanding Saudi Arabia take in any number of refugees. And you don't hear anyone calling Japan Nazis for not wanting to be multicultural. All non-white countries are allowed to be homogenous. If Peru or Algeria closed their borders tomorrow, no one would call them racist. But we all know what would happen if Germany or UK would choose to close their borders. We are not allowed to vote on these policies, despite a growing concern among European populations. There must be an open border policy into white countries. Anyone who opposes these policies is called a racist or Nazis who want to kill 6 million Jews. This is all part of the anti-white mindset. Are similar policies enforced anywhere else that is considered genocide? We need only look east to see very similar policies taking place in the occupied land of Tibet. The situation in Tibet is that they have forced open border policy and are subjected to mass Han Chinese immigration. The ethnic Tibetans are now in fact a minority in their own country. Their culture is undergoing profound changes and the population is forced to assimilate with the foreign migrants. The Tibetans have no choice in this matter. They are not allowed to vote for or against these policies taking place. Sounds familiar? The consequences of these policies will lead to an even more reduced population of Tibetans, and if nothing changes, they will ultimately risk extinction if the Han Chinese continue with these policies. In other words, genocide. The Dalai Lama himself has, of course, spoken out against these policies several times, but to no avail. He has even questioned the similar policies taking place in Europe, warning about the consequences of the massive third world immigration and the refugee phenomenon. Tibet is, of course, only one contemporary example of the acts of genocide. There are many historical examples of such acts, which we will not go into detail here. But the question we should all ask ourselves: if what is happening in Tibet is acknowledged as genocide by international law and per definition, then why do some people deny it when the very same policies are being enforced in predominantly white countries? So, everybody, that was the lesson to be learned for today, some history of South Africa, the reality of what genocide and white genocide in particular really is. I thank you for listening. We will be back same time, same place next week with more information on white genocide, what is happening in South Africa, and why it is important to the rest of the world. God bless America, God bless South Africa, and God help the world we live in today. And I am playing out with my personal act of defiance, the stem.